You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as the Greek economic crisis continues, so does the exodus. We find out which European country is dealing with a sudden influx of middle-class Athenians. Is the age of austerity coming to an end? Ben Chu, economics editor at The Independent, thinks it could be. We'll be hearing from him on what is changing the minds of European economic policymakers. And we have the third of our half-hour special programmes on cities. What makes them great and what can make them better? Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck sits down with the mayor of Tel Aviv, Ron Huldai, and Ajit Gulabchand, mayor of Lavassa. All that, plus a song or two, coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The Treasury Secretary of the United States, Timothy Geithner, has today increased pressure on Syria, warning that more than 55 countries would seek to impose financial pressure on President Bashar al-Assad's government in an effort to stop his government's violence against the Syrian people.
Now, to those nations that have not yet adopted formal sanctions against the Syrian regime and its supporters, we urge you to move quickly to do so. We see no justification for allowing senior members of the Assad regime to have the benefit of accessing the global financial system.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, facing criticism over a decision to vote against legislation that would have legalized settlements built on private Palestinian land, has sought today to reassure his political allies that he remains committed to settlement building. The right-wing leader had pledged to abide by a Supreme Court ruling and remove five settler apartment houses erected on disputed tracts in the settlement of Beit El. Meanwhile, members of the Netherlands football squad have taken time away from their Euro 2012 preparations to visit two Nazi death camps in Poland. They spent time at Auschwitz, where 1.5 million mostly Jewish victims perished during the Second World War, and also visited Birkenau. The Dutch players greeted their Italian counterparts at Birkenau, while they lit memorial candidates at Auschwitz, leaving them at a wall where executions took place. Political and business corruption in Europe could further weaken vulnerable economies struggling to overcome the euro crisis, an international watchdog has said today. The managing director of Transparency International, Cobus de Swart, was bleak in his assessment.
Countries such as Ireland, Portugal, Greece will be selling off massive amount of state assets in the next couple of years in order to pay their debts. If those processes continue under existing transparency mechanisms that exist, those funds will neither be fully utilized potentially, and instead of being making a contribution to way out of the crisis, might even exacerbate some of the existing problems.
Up to 1,000 Tamils have protested today here in central London over the presence of the Sri Lankan President Mahinda Rajapaksa at a special Queen's Jubilee Commonwealth lunch. They accuse Rajapaksa of being a war criminal and are angry he was honoured with an invitation to the lunch. Chanting genocide and terrorist, the protesters, including the director of the Tamil charity Act Now, Sakalingam Yogalingam, want Rajapaksa tried for war crimes at The Hague.
We are not against the Queen, but we are against his being here and getting the support of the British people and the world, even though he's a dictator and the criminal genocide of Tamils. So all the Tamils with the British people and everybody here to protest against him, he should not be here having a lunch with the British people.
And finally, according to a global survey from Ipsos, older, more traditional pastimes and technologies have actually come out on top, with two-thirds of people around the world happy to give up their mobile phone than keep their computer, and 58% happy to live without social networking than lose their television. Sex fared even better in the match-up. Nearly 80% of people said they would rather lose their phone than give up on sex. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you. Jonathan Wheatley, very difficult to follow as ever. It is 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, according to the Swedish Migration Board, the number of Greeks granted residence permits has more than doubled between 2010 and 2011 and is set to rise even higher this year. Many of them are middle-class professionals, but few are having much luck finding work. The National Greek Federation in Stockholm has already reported a rising number of homeless Greeks in Sweden. To tell us more, I'm joined now by James Savage, managing editor of the Swedish newspaper The Local. James, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. Now, let's not take this too much out of context. We're talking about hundreds at the moment rather than thousands. But, I mean, can you sort of give us some sort of an insight into the sort of problems that they're facing?
Well, I mean, the problems that they're facing is that they're coming here often without jobs, without any command of the Swedish language, and without really any idea of how they're going to make a life here. Finding housing is difficult, particularly if you come to Stockholm, the capital, where you've got great difficulties for even for native residents of finding somewhere to live. So the idea that, you know, you can just come off a plane from Greece and land on your feet in Stockholm is a little bit naive, and it's leading to a lot of Greek people, according to Greek associations in Stockholm. It's leading to a lot of Greek people in Stockholm ending up literally on the streets.
And generally speaking, I mean, how sort of welcoming do Swedish people tend to be towards migrants, towards people coming in to the country looking for work?
Relatively welcoming. Sweden encourages it encourages immigration for work purposes from areas even outside the EU, for people who have got the skills and can find a job. They've got very relaxed legislation on that front. They have free Swedish classes for immigrants. Also, the Swedish people in general, they're a nice bunch of people. There's not a huge amount of anti-immigrant sentiment. There is an anti-immigrant party in the Swedish Parliament, but it only gets about 4 or 5% of the vote. So it's a reasonably welcoming country on many levels, but it's a hard place. Like any new country where you don't speak the language, it's a hard place to integrate.
And when we look at the problem, particularly for Greeks, when we look at the issues that they're facing right now, I mean, what are these Greek organisations working in Stockholm saying they feel needs to be done or could be done to try and ease the situation?
Well, they think there needs to be better information in Greece about the fact that Sweden is not an easy option. They believe that in Greece the word has gone round that Scandinavia is a good place to come because the economy is good, because the general benefits available to immigrants once you have a residence permit are reasonably good. The word has gone out in Greece that this is a good place to come, and they say the Greek associations in Sweden are saying that actually we need to get the word out in Greece that really, it's not all roses, and if you come here, you can expect a pretty hard time if you don't have the right skills and the right contacts to get a job.
And when we look at the situation from a Swedish point of view, I mean, have we got to the stage yet where it's something that the local authorities or even the government need to start thinking about specifically about what they do with their Greek immigrant population?
Well, I mean, we are still talking about relatively small numbers. So I think the Swedish government, when it comes to immigration, they've got bigger fish to fry right now. But I think that this is certainly something that it will be in the Swedish government's interest to nip in the bud before hundreds turn into thousands. Because obviously, if the situation in Greece gets worse, then this situation could get much more serious.
I mean, to put this into context, you know, Sweden isn't used to experiencing a large number of migrants from a fellow European nation. You know, they have many migrants from, you know, from say Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq. Can you give us a flavour of the sort of, you know, migrants that Sweden normally attracts rather than the Greeks?
Well, The largest group of migrants are from other Scandinavian countries, where obviously the language is less of a problem. Swedes and Norwegians and Danes pretty much can speak their own languages and understand each other. Or from Finland, where a lot of people speak Swedish. And then you have the migrants who come from further afield. In the last decade, we've had a lot of Iraqis and Somalians who've come here. And you know, in a sense, a Greek may have an easier time of it in Sweden than an Iraqi or Somalian, but their expectations are certainly likely to be very different as well. And Iraqis and Somalis have come here for reasons of asylum, and so there's a whole system set up to take care of them and to make sure that they have what they need to survive. But there really is nothing like that set up for people coming from within the European Union.
And just finally, I mean, if you were to sort of cast your mind forward another year, if this crisis in Greece continues as it certainly seems it's going to, and if the numbers increase of Greeks coming to countries like Sweden, I mean, what sort of scenes can you expect to seeing?
Well, that's a really big question. If Greeks come to Sweden in larger numbers, you're going to see a lot of people who have who are literally on the streets because there is no real system set up to take care of them in Sweden. They don't have the right to benefits and they don't have the right to asylum. So we're also going to see people being physically deported from one European Union country to another in relatively large numbers if this continues. And that's also something that really we haven't seen much of before. So that will be interesting.
James Savage, Managing Editor of The Local in Sweden, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back with a song right after this.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
On the 16th and 17th of June, please join us at Midori House, the London headquarters of Monocle, as we break out the bunting for the very first Monocle Country Fair, our unique global take on a gloriously English tradition, complete with market stalls hosted by some of our favourite nations and shopkeepers. We'll have face painting for children, marvellous musical performances, a guest chef in the kitchen, and much more. The Monocle Country Fair will be running from 11 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon on the 16th and 17th of June at Midori House, 1 Dorset Street, in the heart of London's Marylebone. For more information, head to monocle.com/countryfair, and that's fair with a Y, of course.
Of course that's fair with a Y. I hope you'll all be there. We have a petting zoo. Did you know that? Sophie didn't mention that in the little promotional thing there, did she? Yes, goats, real life goats and pigs, and I believe 4 rabbits as well, all in the courtyard here at Midori House. And many other reasons to come as well, but, you know, the rabbits I'm sure is good. We're going to play some music now. This is Changes by Crazy P. That was Changes by Crazy P. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is Midori House. And you are back with Midori House here on Monocle 24. After an initial burst of Keynesian stimuli in the wake of the global financial crisis, a consensus among governments, international institutions and the majority of mainstream economists settled on austerity as the only possible road to recovery. Yet with the Eurozone crisis spinning out of control and other Western economies, most notably the UK's, heading back into recession, has the austerity bubble burst? Tomorrow morning on The Foreign Desk, a special edition of The Globalist, I'll be exploring the issue in more detail. But to give you a little taster, let's hear from Ben Chu, economics editor at The Independent newspaper. A little earlier, I met him at The Independent's newsroom in central London. OK, let's start with the big question. Has austerity definitely failed?
Well, for 2 years now, we've been putting these policies into practice, and the results haven't been good. Growth has collapsed in Europe. Growth is massively disappointed here in the UK. The US has not had quite the same austerity and its economy has done a bit better. So I think as a field study, we've had a pretty clear indication that austerity has not delivered the goods.
But are politicians responding to that and thinking, okay, this didn't work, let's change track? Is there anywhere where you see politicians are sort of taking that message?
I think in Europe, Germany is still very much in the austerity must be given more time and austerity will work. But I think in the rest of Europe, certainly, there's a view that things have to change. We saw that in the Greek elections. We saw that in the French elections where they voted for François Hollande, who had a very clear platform of going for growth rather than just austerity. I think we're seeing it to some extent in the UK as well now. The Labour opposition has always said that you need to put growth first. Growth is the key to getting our deficits down. They're getting more of a hearing now, and even the government is looking towards trying to pump up infrastructure projects as a way of getting investment moving in the economy. It's not a plan B, but it is a recognition that there needs to be more spending in the economy, that you simply cannot just cut government deficits and expect private growth to flood in and fill the gap.
Is part of the problem that, you know, those who've been in favour of austerity haven't necessarily been in favour of it for strong economic reasons? It's been more ideological.
I think there's certainly been an element of faith-based policy making. There was never really a solid evidence base to suggest that at a time of a global downturn that cutting government deficits would result in some huge explosion of private sector enthusiasm for spending. Where it has worked in the past, governments have cut spending, they've been able to report to neighbours who've been booming. So there was never really the evidence base there to suggest that this was going to work.
So in a sense, is it then a failure of, you know, commentators like yourself and others who feel you can prove, could have proved beforehand that this wasn't going to work? No one was really listening to you, were they?
Well, I think there were some powerful voices who said that this isn't going to work. Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, Danny Blanchflower, who writes for The Independent, Jonathan Porter, Simon Wren-Lewis. There were prominent voices who were saying that this isn't going to work. They weren't listened to. I think that was partly because some of the big multilateral organisations such as the IMF, the OECD, were very much in the view that austerity, there could be an expansionary fiscal contraction, if you like, that, you know, cutting deficits would deliver the goods. And I think governments looked at those institutions, saw they had their backing, and took some heart from that. And I think, you know, if I was trying to apportion blame, first I'd put it on the politicians who've enacted these policies, and I'd also put it on those institutions which basically gave them their seal of approval.
If we accept that austerity hasn't worked now and that something is going to change, what are the sort of changes which you... Well, there's two questions here. What should happen, what will happen? Let's start with what you think should happen next.
Well, I think the most important thing to happen in Europe and also in the UK is that they should ease off on the pace of deficit reduction. You need a plan. It's good that they have a plan to get them down. You can't keep borrowing 8% of your GDP or whatever indefinitely. That would result in an explosion of debts and a loss of confidence. So there needs to be a plan, but there's no need to do it on such a tight timetable. By easing off the pace of them, they can give the private sector time to recover. They can keep some spending in the economy, and this can help support growth and recovery. And that goes for the UK, it goes for Spain, it goes for Greece, it goes for all of those countries around the periphery. Now, the UK can do it without any trouble off its own back because it can borrow in its own currency. It still controls its own currency. Countries like Spain and Italy and Greece and Ireland, which are, don't control their own currency, need some help from Germany and the European Central Bank to do that. So that's where the policy change needs to come from in Europe. It needs to come from the core countries of Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, etc., accepting that those countries need to be cut a break, and it also needs the ECB to inject some demand into the economy by cutting interest rates and buying up government bonds, etc.
When we look back on this period in, you know, maybe 10, 20 years' time, how damaging will it have been? Is it just that we've had 2 years of you know, very little growth and, you know, recession across the world, but we'll soon recover as soon as policies change? Or are there going to be real long-term impacts which we'll feel for decades to come?
Well, there's certainly going to be a long-term impact on the people who have now been unemployed for the best part of 2 years. Long-term unemployment has gone up, and studies show that that does have considerable scarring effects on people for the rest of their lives. Prolonged period of unemployment in relatively early life, say after you've just graduated, does have an impact, and that is a long-term cost. There are other long-term costs here as well. You know, the euro was supposed to bring Europe together. This was part of the project. This was to bind Europeans, to give them a sense of common identity. But what we've actually seen is, because of its incomplete structure and because of the mistakes of policymakers, they've actually been driven apart. You know, you see swastika flags in Greece as an objection to German policies, and you see similar kind of insulting things about Greeks in the German political discourse. This wasn't what was supposed to happen, and that is going to be, unless they can sort it out, that could be a potentially very serious long-term cost, that loss of European unity, this project which has been built up over 4 or 5 decades now, going into reverse effectively. So, yes, I think the stakes are very high, and it's incumbent on politicians everywhere to do what's necessary to defuse all these crises and return the global economy to growth.
And how hopeful are you that those things will happen?
I think it's approaching crunch time in Europe. I think they've pretty much hit a brick wall now. They need to choose. I think I have a relatively, perhaps naive, but I have a degree of confidence that if it comes down to it, the German people will be prepared to underwrite the Eurozone. I think the European Central Bank will do what's necessary if there is the only option is to do that or to see the whole thing disintegrate. But that's dependent on people being faced with very stark choices. Now, what needs to happen is people need to be told those very stark choices. There's still an air of denial, even now at this very late hour, 5 to midnight. There's an air of denial amongst policymakers. We need to get beyond that very quickly indeed. Then I think you can find some hope.
That was Ben Chu, economics editor at The Independent, and you can hear more on this subject tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. London time on The Foreign Desk, a special edition of The Globalist. And that's all from this section of Midori House. It was produced by Dawn Trump, our researcher was Ben Jay, studio manager was Alex Funnell and Toby Hammond. I'm Steve Bloomfield, and in the next half hour on Midori House, we have the third of our 5 special reports this week looking at startup cities. Stay tuned for that. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. The Treasury Secretary of the United States has today increased pressure on Syria, warning that more than 53 countries would seek to impose financial pressure on President Bashar al-Assad's government. The Israeli Prime Minister, facing criticism over a decision to vote against legislation that would have legalised settlements built on private Palestinian land, has sought today to reassure his political allies that he remains committed to settlement building. Members of the Netherlands football squad have taken time away from their Euro 2012 preparations to visit 2 Nazi death camps in Poland. The Dutch players greeted their Italian counterparts at Birkenau. Political and business corruption in Europe could further weaken vulnerable economies struggling to overcome the euro crisis, an international watchdog has said today. And up to 1,000 Tamils have protested here in central London over the presence of the Sri Lankan President Mahindra Rajapaksa at a special Queen's Jubilee Commonwealth lunch. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and I'm Andrew Tuck. Today, on our week-long special cities series, we find out why cities are racing to become hubs for startups, and why attracting businesses to your metropolis is more than about just tax incentives. We'll hear from the head of the Hindustan construction company, Ajit Gulabchand, about how the concept of the Indian hill town is being reimagined for new entrepreneurs.
Cities consist of art centres, museums, libraries, where people can interact with each other, have views expressed with each other. And we hope we create sufficient attraction that all these people that make a city come there.
But first, we sit down with Mayor Ron Huldai, whose 14 years in the hot seat at Tel Aviv City Hall has transformed Israel's second largest city. Huldai wants to attract young entrepreneurs to set up there, and he knows that one of the city's greatest assets in getting tech talent to take root in Tel Aviv is its nightlife and beach culture.
Mayor Huldai, I wonder if we could start, first of all, with the brand of Tel Aviv, how Tel Aviv is seen now around the world. I don't think there is any city that has changed its opinion, how people see it, any more effectively than Tel Aviv over the last few years. You're seen as a liberal beacon in a very difficult region. You're seen as a place that attracts young people. Did you realise when you started out your mayoralty that you were going to be able to change the way that people saw the city so effectively?
No, I can't say that I saw it from the beginning. When I became the mayor of Tel Aviv, and we have to realise it, the city of Tel Aviv was in a very difficult time at that time. It was on the verge of bankruptcy. And it's a huge deficit, huge debt. The infrastructure in a very bad situation. And the most important thing is that it was a negative balance of immigration. More people left the city than joined the city. I didn't invade the creativity and productivity of the Tel Aviv area. It's, in a way, in the DNA of our culture. I am not so sure that somebody can say he knows exactly why things are happening. And I am not the one to say that I know everything. But what I can say is that this is not a project, it's a way of life, it's there. Since it's there, everything we did is to use everything to leverage it, to bring it better, to bring more opportunities to people, to create better quality of life. As I sometimes phrase it in a way to say, I'm creating small villages in a city, because I created equality and accessibility. When people has accessibility to everything, it's become very interesting. And try to mention one city in the world that in 1 year, last year, inaugurated new museum, new cinematheque, a new national theater in 5 months. And the fact is that there is no major issue. It's a holistic approach to create, let's say, the ecosystem, encourage people to live, to enjoy their lives, to have fun, because if they are very creative, they would like to have fun. When they are leaving office very late at night, they would like to see bars and pubs. We have 1,748 pubs and bars, one for 220 residents. In this, let's say, small city, the city of Tel Aviv, 400,000 that acquiring 1 million entering as commuters every day in and out. So when you ask me what is the major, I don't know. I'm looking for a way of life that anybody can find what he wants in the city. And that's exactly what young people want.
And you're also lobbying national government to change the visa regulations, I understand, to make it easier for startup people to come to the city.
We are now looking for a global vision to bring or to be the hub for anybody outside of the United States who want to develop high-tech company. And to do so, one of the major obstacles is the working visa in the state of Israel. That's the reason we are now working on this with the government. I can't say that if I'm optimistic or pessimistic, because I don't know yet what are going to be the results, but we think that Israel has to develop this kind of working visa, because we find that there is a lot of young people or investors in the world that wants to do it, and what is the, and this is the major obstacle. I just met a young lady. She came to Israel and spent maybe 9 months with tourist visa, open and high-tech company, and had to leave Israel. And she is now managing her company because she hired a manager in Israel, and she is traveling from time to time. It's not reasonable to do business this way. So that's the reason we are working on it.
And what's the benefit for you as a mayor running Tel Aviv of having so many high-tech companies in the city? Is it jobs, or is it just that you see that's the future of the economy?
Everything that is good for the city is good for the nation. This is it. There's nothing that I can say that's good only for the city. We are part of Israel. We are the center of Israel. We are the financial center of Israel. We are the art and culture center of Israel. By the way, everybody is Tel Avivian in Israel. Because everybody, wherever he lives, he comes to eat, to enjoy, to the beach.
Do you think, though, that you say everyone is Tel Avivian in Israel? But what's interesting, I wonder if you measured the brand of Tel Aviv and the brand of Israel, and you asked people questions about what they represented. I think that actually, you know, through the problems that are in the region, that Tel Aviv would have a slightly easier brand for many people than the state of Israel. Is that something that benefits you as a city?
I'll take it differently. First of all, I'm sorry to say that as a Tel Avivian, I'm not happy with the fact that sometimes the brand Tel Aviv is something like bypass of the conflict. As an Israeli, I'm not happy with it. But if I cannot ignore it, I have to find ways to live in this situation. And what we did in the last couple of years, especially during our centennial year, that we really branded our city and we marketed our city, and we got a lot of recognition, because if National Geographic says that we are one of the 10 nicest beach cities in the world, or lately we were elected as the most gay-friendly city in the world, or New York Times recognized Tel Aviv as the capital of the Mediterranean cool, okay? Or one of the, I don't know the number of the economic development cities. So it that's because a lot of effort we are doing to promote our city. And we see it, by the way, the way that tourists see Tel Aviv. 10 years ago, most of the tourists that came to the city were business people. Today, most of the tourists are people that are coming to have a fun in the city of Tel Aviv, and the average stay in Tel Aviv more than doubled in the last 10 years in the city. So the occupancy is very nice. So,
tell me, the blueprint you have for the Tel Aviv's success, I wonder if people are beginning to copy you a little bit, because you look up the coast to Holon. The mayor of Holon seems to be building lots of art institutions. Do you think that the special power you have in Tel Aviv at the moment will begin to kind of be diluted as other people around Israel try to copy the Ron Huldai method of...
First of all, I'm even not using the word copying. I am always happy when somebody getting ideas for somebody else and trying to do better in his city. I don't see the design center in Holon as a competition to Tel Aviv. I see it as something that, as a complementary effort to create a better art and culture metropolitan, around the city. If there is a one event in Israel, all of the hotels around in Herzliya or Holon or Bat Yam are full to full too, and it's good for everybody. I never compete with other cities around it with me, and I always I always see as a privilege to see that something is somebody around us doing the same. It's okay. Unfortunately, when we introduced the bicycles for rent in our city, the cities around us didn't cooperate, and today they are sorry about it because their residents cannot commute to the city, and sometimes the city of the Givatayim is closer to my office than my home in Tel Aviv, in the north of Tel Aviv. So
perhaps almost finally, could I just ask you about the one of the things that many startup companies need is great technology. They're worried about how smart their cities are, how fast the Wi-Fi works, what the city's ambitions are for being a smart city. Is that something you feel is the responsibility of the mayor's office, or do you think that's the responsibility of private companies in partnership with you?
Together. I think, I'll tell you something. I was in Germany a week or 2 weeks ago. I hardly could find a free Wi-Fi, either in coffee shops or in hotels. In my city, in every coffee shop, you get free Wi-Fi, and we are now providing more and more free Wi-Fi in open space, in the boulevards, in the port of Tel Aviv, and so forth, because we think that that's the way it should be, because if you want people to be free to work and to do and to be innovative, you have to make them free of, let's say, bureaucracy. At the same time, the private sector, if they want to make business, they have to think about the ways to encourage other young people to be involved in their businesses. If they see that the city are not doing, they have to do something about it. That's the way it is. But it's always the same.
That was me talking to Mayor Ron Huldai of Tel Aviv. Next, we'll head to India to take a look at a 21st century hill town. But first, a song. Here's XTC with Working Overtime.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com. It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and I'm Andrew Tuck. India needs to build hundreds of new cities and towns to relieve its buckling metropolises. Why not create tiny tech hubs then with a quality of life? Lavasa, a project managed by the Hindustan Construction Company, looks more like Portofino than Pune, the city on whose outskirts it sits. With research, learning and tech at its heart, Lavasa hopes to set a new urban model in the country and be more than just a smart resort. We sat down with the head of the HCC, Ajit Gulabchand, to hear about how he's out to attract startups and not big corporate HQs.
The Maharashtra state, one of the provinces states of India, decided that it needed to build more hill cities or stations, because during the British rule in India, they used to have a lot of hill stations where the British would run up to the mountains in the hot weather. However, they proved to be great attractions for tourists and others, and they felt that they should build new hill cities in India, in the state, and had this lake district of sorts got created because of different artificial lakes created for irrigation or for power generation, etc. So with this idea in mind, they called for people to come forth to build cities. And we were one of them that felt that we should come and do that, because it's an extraordinary enterprise. One of the more important reasons is India is going to have a migration of about 400 million people moving to cities in the next 30 years. And that's a huge migration. It took 1,000 years for that many people to migrate to cities in Europe. It's all going to happen in the next 30, 35 years. And so India will need 500 new cities. It will need many new neighborhoods to existing cities, as well as it will need to reorganize some of the cities in order to accommodate this migration. So our challenge is now, how do you create a sustainable city? We have to ensure that the environmental footprint of the city is good. So we're using different models of new urbanization planning, of dense construction, a walking city, you know, like of the total area, we would construct only on 30%. In that 30%, 80% of the people will live in 20% of that land. So the commuting and movement is very limited, and therefore it creates a large walking. Having done all this, still we are in an area which has been denuded for the last 100 years, for serving wood coal to Pune city, about 100 miles from there. And so in order to deal with that, we have to actually enhance the environment by plantation. Large plantation of almost 3 to 4 million trees will be planted. All the slopes will be greened again to bring serious watershed management, so that the water table of that region, which has dropped to 20%, is restored back to its original 60%. So that is one challenge of environment. Second is that you have to create the economy, because without that, nobody will come. So there is a economic sustainability that's important. And lastly, the migration to this place is not going to take place from one place, of one community, of one class of people. It's going to take place from all over India. It'll be taking place in all socioeconomic spectrum. And therefore, social sustainability is equally important. And so the whole sustainability model is in environmental, economic, and social.
Do you think the Lavasa, if it's a success, and I'm sure it will offer a model for developing other cities across India? Is this an attempt to create a template, in a way, for India?
Our objective is that we create a template so that it can be replicable. Now, we're not saying this is the only answer to the huge need of cities in India. And the whole new requirement is so immense. This is one such model of a public-private partnership that can create a new city and can be replicated. We are already discussing with 2 or 3 other states who want to build neighborhoods or new cities, including Bhutan, which wants to create an education and tourism city, not very different from what Lavasa is. And so here is a new intellectual property that we can offer. But nevertheless, we would like to make it a replicable model. And I'm sure it'll be just one more model that perhaps would work. And the other advantage of Lavasa is we have today so far built the first town of the four to five towns that will constitute the city. And about 1,500 apartments and things are already there. There are about 15 education institutions are already there. Five hotels have already come up of the 20, 30, 40 hotels that will come there. And there again, right from five-star Pullman hotels down to dormitory hotels for, you know, there are lots of small people that will be constantly traveling, you know, truck drivers, couriers. There is a whole host of people, and the gap is very different, and they also need to live somewhere. We don't ask this question in Paris, because it's evolved over the years. But when you want to build new, you have to begin with this as well. So from that point of view, we've tried to look at it as a more wholesome model. And we hope we succeed in creating this public-private partner. Even its governance tomorrow is going to be another issue. Should it remain purely private, or should there be again a new form of public-private partnership for its governance? And the reason I say this is that so many new cities and towns and urban centers have to be created that unless you have a public-private partnership at all fronts, from the infrastructure for the city, from the management of the city, and the governance aspects of the city, I think India would, or countries like India, Africa, China, would find it difficult to cope with the speed with which they have to deliver this.
I was going to ask you that many planned cities aren't always the most fun places to be. Is that something that you are concerned about as you design your city?
Yeah. My sleepless nights are not about putting infrastructure there. My sleepless nights are not because that we don't know yet what would be the governance structure that evolves. How do we green this place again? I mean, these are not the problems that I have spent. How do we breathe a soul in the city? You know, finally, cities consist of art centers, museums, libraries, where people can interact with each other, have views expressed with each other. You also have all the naughty nightclubs that are required. Unless it has a gay parade, you won't even call it a city. There are several such issues of that will finally make the soul of the city. And we hope we create sufficient attraction that all these wonderful people that make a city come there.
And finally, can I ask you, when you look around modern India, a country changing at an extraordinary pace, and you go to its cities, do you have hope and optimism for the future of the city in India, or do you think that the challenges are just too huge now?
See, let us put it, let us not underestimate the challenges that countries like India will face. At the same time, I can show you how many things that were never going to happen in India that have happened. We were never going to feed ourselves. We are now not only feeding, but exporting. We had two horrible television channels, state-run, unwatchable, just in 1993-94. Today we have 700 channels and growing. Maybe they're still a bit unwatchable, but the fact is that they're highly competing, of which so many. We have FM radio, which not allowed to talk on current affairs and to discuss, give out news. But this will also break open. I give you many examples of a country like India where things were never going to happen have started happening because the people of India have an enormous energy, a very entrepreneurial, very hardworking. And as we have changed our way of looking at things, you know, we had a Moscow model of central planning in the economy. Politically, we have been free. And it's a large challenge. Look, we're just 65 years
old in the sense we are old. We are a very ancient country of more than 5,000 years. However, even 7,000 years. However, we have been ruled by foreign invaders for almost 900 years. 700 years of Islamic invasions, then the British. So we've got our independence back after 1,000 years. And in 65 years, we have been able to come up to be the third largest economy in the world. So there's something there. It is not a dictatorial state. It is not an authoritarian or a totalitarian state. So you don't look for what's going to happen in India to the government of India, but you look to the people. And when you go around the people, you will see the energy there. And that is what is optimistic about India. And being a democracy, it has corrective measures. And it will therefore evolve and it will change.
That was me speaking to Ajit Gulabchand. Well, that's all for this special cities outing. I'm Andrew Tuck.